Welcome to today's episode of the Normalized Surrogacy Podcast by Surrogacy Mentor. I'm your host, Marielle Schubert, three-time experienced gestational surrogate and intake manager for Surrogacy Mentor and Modern Parent Mentor, where our aim is a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey for all. Today, I'm excited to have experienced surrogate Lindsay with us. Lindsay just delivered her first Suro baby in September. So welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you so much.
Let's see. And today's topic, expect the unexpected. Today, Lindsay will share her experiences as a GC who found herself carrying a high-risk pregnancy for her intended parents. So before we get into all of that, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and your family and what made you want to be a surrogate in the first place?
Sure. Well, I am married. I have three kids of my own. Their ages right now are 12, 10, and 7. And, you know, I've known, I think, pretty much since my 7-year-old was born that I eventually wanted to do at least one surrogacy. It always kind of felt like a bit of a calling for me to be able to do this. And I got to the point in my life where, you know, I was getting older and it was sort of a now or never situation because I'm now 40. I was 38 when we started the process and I didn't want to let time get away from me. And so my husband and I made a decision to, yes, we're going to go ahead and do this. I was lucky enough, and it's really just purely luck. I find that I had very uneventful pregnancies and deliveries with my own three kids. Really no issues at all. And, you know, it's not lost on me that that's can be an unusual situation. It was just the hand that I was dealt. I'm so grateful that I was given that gift. And I thought that because of that, I would be such a good candidate for surrogacy. I thought this would be so great and easy and wonderful and magical. And it was wonderful, but definitely not at all what I expected in so many ways.
Yeah. And that is typical. I think a lot of women going into surrogacy do it because they enjoyed pregnancy and had easy pregnancies and things like that. And so you just assume, rightfully so, that it's going to go the same, because why wouldn't it? All of mine were so easy. You know, in my journeys, my own pregnancies, I had very similar. They were uneventful, healthy. I felt great. Babies were good. I thought, cool, I'm just meant to be a pregnant person.
Yes.
And I definitely had some complications in my last one that kind of developed as well. So it can happen to anybody.
For sure.
And so I totally understand all of that.
Yeah.
So how did your spouse and family and friends react to you wanting to be a surrogate? It's not something that people hear every day.
It's not. And I don't know anyone else personally who's been a surrogate. So, you know, my husband was incredibly supportive right from the beginning, which I found out during the whole process was absolutely crucial. Could not have done it without the support of, you know, that one main person in my life. I think I got mixed reactions from some family and friends, some really supportive, some skeptical of the process, you know, maybe not thinking it's the best idea, you know, questioning possible attachment to the baby, ethics of the surrogacy process in general. So it was a real mixed bag for me. And I found that, you know, it was important for me to sort of just gravitate towards those people who were going to be supportive during that time and just try not to think about the other stuff, because that's kind of, you know, what helped me. So,
yeah. And it's unfortunately very common to kind of be met with all of those from people who just don't necessarily understand the process.
Right.
You know, the media and movies, Lifetime movie channel is probably one of the worst perpetrators of what surrogacy is not. But people have this idea in their head of all of these terrible things, or, you know, you generally hear about the one story that went bad, not the hundreds that go well. And so I think a lot of people's reactions are just kind of based on misinformation and things that they don't know. But I'm glad that you were able to at least have some in your corner that got it, and that you had that support from your husband, because I can also attest to that having that main support person around for the good and the bad is definitely kind of essential to the whole process, whether that's a spouse or a friend or family, but just having somebody who is in your corner always is definitely extremely helpful. And so I'm glad that you were able to have that. So how did your children feel about you carrying a baby for someone else? Were they old enough to kind of understand?
You know, my older two, for sure. My youngest was 5 when I started this whole process. And so I tried to explain it in, you know, pretty simple terms. I think it's really important for us as parents in this generation to be open with our kids about how families can be made in a variety of different ways. It's not always just a mom and a dad. This is the world that we live in. And, you know, everybody that really wants to have a baby, I think should be able to have that opportunity. And so I think it was a real teaching moment for my kids and, you know, important for me to be really honest and open about the process, how it works, you know, what they can expect. And ultimately they, you know, were really supportive and great. And I'm really proud of them, how they got through the whole process, you know, how we got through it all as a family. So.
Yeah. And that's amazing. And I love that, you were able to involve them in all of that, because I think, from my personal experience, that's a big sticking point that a lot of people like to focus on, is how are your children going to react to this? Like watching you give away a baby, they want to take it home. And at least with my personal experience, my kids didn't care. It was made very clear to them from the beginning. And in the end, they were able to see the family that they helped create. And it gave them a sense of purpose as well in all of it, that they were able to be a part of that. And so I found the opposite, that it didn't mess up my kids. It actually helped empower them to like do good. And at no point were they like sad that they weren't getting a baby out of it. Did you have a similar experience, or how did your kids kind of respond to you being pregnant and not coming home with the baby?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, it is important to explain how the process works even from the beginning. But, you know, when we were going through it and I was having pregnancy complications, you know, just reminding them all the time, guys, I know this is hard right now, but remember what we're doing this for. Like at the end of this, you know, we are helping make a family. And I feel like they were, you know, a part of that. Their support was really important to me too. And so they were very much a part of, you know, look what we're doing. Look how this is going to end up really wonderful. And so let's just get through it. And, you know, they're little people, they understand that, and they sort of had a handle on the situation, I think maybe even better than I expected. So yeah, I was really proud of them.
I guess let's let that roll kind of right into your surrogacy experience. So you were matched through an agency.
Yeah.
How was that process for you? Did you have like a quick process from when you signed on to getting matched with intended parents? How did your kind of beginning phases before entering into pregnancy, how did that process go for you?
Yeah. Once I, you know, signed with an agency and got sent profiles for potential intended parents, I started the process knowing specifically that I wanted to carry for a same-sex male couple. I just, in my own experience, I have a background as an OB nurse. And so I've seen surrogacy, you know, been on the other side of, you know, taking care of people in a surrogate situation, heterosexual couples, same-sex couples. And I think there's just something really special about a same-sex male couple, and they have to work really hard in every way to get a child, with donor eggs and a surrogate. And it's just a long process to go through. And so I wanted to be that for that kind of a couple. And so those are the profiles that I was looking at, and pretty quickly found a couple that I just sort of knew that they were the ones. I mean, it was really obvious kind of right away. And we set up a Zoom meeting with them to meet, kind of get to know each other a little bit. And it was a real mutual feeling between me and my husband and the two of them that, yeah, we feel really good about this. Like, this is a good match. And so I matched pretty quickly, really. It was an easy process for me. That was maybe the easiest part of this whole process.
Which is great, because that's not, you know, sometimes the beginning, you know, phase of a journey can be the longest as far as all of that goes. So yeah. You meet your intended parents. Everybody feels that click, that when you know, kind of feeling, which is great. Did legal and all of that go quickly and smoothly. I know that can be another hang up
for
that
sure.
You encounter during a journey.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely took longer than I expected. And I think some of that had to do with the fact that they're an international couple and, you know, with time difference and just communication, I think took longer between lawyer and lawyer. And so I definitely was a little bit impatient with that because, you know, once you make the decision to be a surrogate, you want to get going, you want to get started. And so, yeah, the legal definitely took longer than I hoped, but, you know, it is what it is. There's nothing I could really do about it.
Yep. And that's so true. Even under the best circumstances, you change one word and it has to go from approval to your lawyer, to their lawyer, to their approval. And then when you add in a language difference, then there's a whole different slew of things. So a lot of times, even if you're not changing major things in your contract, just the bouncing between all parties can take some time for sure. And so you get that done and it's time for transfer. So everything kind of went smoothly to get to transfer. How many embryos did you transfer for your first time and how did your transfer go? And start us off with your journeys.
So the couple had 3 embryos total, just 3. And I had agreed to do up to 3 transfers to hopefully get a successful story. We did transfer an embryo in August of 2022 and it took, everything was going really well. Went to the fertility clinic here in my city where we were doing the remote monitoring because I don't live where the fertility clinic was. I had to fly there and got the first ultrasound, saw a great heartbeat. I'm feeling so great. Call the parents, you know, just so much excitement thinking, oh my gosh, the first time this is going to work out. Like, this is so wonderful. And, the very next day I started having a miscarriage, which, you know, super common, definitely, I think a part of this process that, again, I made the assumption I've never had a miscarriage before. I've had such good experiences with my pregnancies. Surely that won't happen to me, which in hindsight is foolish to think that because, you know, nothing's guaranteed. And I have just as much of a chance as anybody else to have those issues. And so I definitely took that really hard. I was really hard on myself. And we as women, you know, we're told don't blame yourselves. But I think part of us always does, thinking what could I have done differently. And it took me a little while to get over that. And so that was the end of September in 2022. And I knew pretty quickly that the journey wasn't over for me, that I wanted to try again, but I just think I needed time to sort of let my body get semi back to normal and, you know, heal a little bit. And so I told the intended parents, I would really like to try again. I think I want to get through the holidays with my family. And then, you know, come January, like let's start over and see if we can make it happen a second time. And so that's what we did. And they were wonderful and patient with me and, you know, just so kind.
Yeah, which is great because it's a very hard thing and weird thing to process as a GC when you have a miscarriage of, you know, of a surrogate pregnancy. I had 2 surrogate miscarriages myself. I'd never had any of my own miscarriages. I kind of went into it the same as you. I'm meant to be pregnant. This is what it is. This is great. And then when it happens, I think miscarriage in general is a very hard thing to process. But when you add in the processing of grief of something that it's not yours, but you were responsible for, and then the disappointment that you know that your intended parents are feeling, it's a very complicated process to kind of go through because there's no rule book here and there's no like guide of how to process loss in general, but how do you process a loss that's not yours? It's a very complex grieving process, for lack of a better term, that I guess everybody just kind of has to go through on their own, but it is definitely very different and something that you don't really know how to handle, I guess, until you're put in there. And were you met with some resistance from friends and family when wanting to try again? Because I know when I said, oh, no, it's not going out like this, I want to try again, everybody looked at me like I was crazy. Like, you just went through all this and you want to do it again? I was like, yeah, I'm not letting it end like this. We're getting them that baby. It just kind of motivated me personally. How did people respond or react to you wanting to try again?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the same as you, it motivated me and I just was committed to this process and I wasn't going to feel okay unless I tried again. But, you know, in my situation, I, because I was initially met with resistance from some people, I decided, you know, when I started the process, I wanted to tell everybody, I'm so excited. Guess what I'm doing? You know, isn't this so great? And then when not everyone shares those same feelings, the second go round, I chose to not tell people until, you know, further on down the process, because I didn't know how it was going to go. If I had another miscarriage, you know, you don't want to tell people who already weren't supportive again. I decided the second time I'm only going to include this little inner circle of people who I know I have support from, because those are the people that I'm going to want to go to if I have another loss. That's who I'm going to want to turn to. And so that was my decision, was to not let everyone know the second time. And I think that just it put me in a better headspace. It was better for me.
You're able to heal from that. You're geared up. You're ready to go. And you try again. So what does your next transfer look like? And how did all of that go?
So the next transfer was their second embryo out of three. And that was at the beginning of February of this year. And I tried to go into it, you know, not thinking about the past. It's a new embryo. It's a new day. And we're just going to think as positively as we can, because, you know, ultimately you do this transfer and it's going to take or it's not. And there's nothing you can do about that. And so I had to just have a positive outlook and just go into it with that. And, that one worked out great, but you're always, after you've experienced a miscarriage, aren't you always, it's always in the back of your mind.
Yep.
And you're looking for every little sign of something going wrong. And so I think it was a little bit more nerve wracking for me the second time around, but, yep. Everything looked really great. And, you know, once we saw a heartbeat and then saw a heartbeat for the second time and a little bit of a later ultrasound, I thought, okay, you know, I think this is going to be okay. I'm feeling pretty good about it.
Kind of passing those milestones definitely gives you that breath of like, okay, we've made it. And it definitely is reassuring. So were you able to kind of enjoy a little bit of your pregnancy after that second confirmation, or was that still kind of lingering that something could happen?
I did. I think, you know, after the initial morning sickness was over, the beginning of the second trimester, I was feeling pretty good. And it wasn't too long after that that the issue started popping up, because there were multiple difficult issues with this pregnancy. And so I feel like, unfortunately for me, the amount of time that I actually got to enjoy it and feel good and feel, you know, really super positive about the way things were going, it was kind of a short period of time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So
I guess there's your intro. So let's lead into that. So you have this little window of deep breath, things are going well. What started to happen when things weren't going so well?
So once I was getting ultrasounds pretty frequently, and once the location of the placenta was visible, it was identified that I had complete placenta previa, where, you know, the placenta's lying over the cervix. And along with that, they found velamentous cord insertion, which means that the umbilical cord, instead of inserting into the sort of the middle of the placenta, inserted into the side, which causes the blood vessels in the umbilical cord to be sort of vulnerable. They're not as protected when they're coming out the side of the placenta. It's just not ideal. And so all of that was identified. And I had multiple subchorionic hemorrhages as well. So I had quite a bit of bleeding involved, and we didn't always know if it was bleeding from the placenta previa or bleeding from the subchorionic hemorrhages that sort of would get better and think they're going away, and then another one would pop back up. I had multiple visits to the hospital for bleeding, just ultrasounds all the time, every week, every 2 weeks, kind of keeping an eye on everything. And this was all new to me. I felt like I was at the doctor's office every single day.
Well, that is a lot going on. I dealt with all of those things separately. Yeah. I had an SCH with my twin pregnancy. I had the placenta previa with my last pregnancy, but not all at once. And I could not imagine how terrifying that must have felt to kind of always be on edge. And I mean, when you're pregnant, it's never fun or a good sign when you see blood there. So yeah. I can only imagine how stressful that must have been. I know with a lot of these, it starts with some restrictions, activity restrictions. What did that process kind of look like for you as you got closer to delivery?
Yeah, so I think before 20 weeks, I definitely had pelvic rest, lifting restrictions. I wasn't supposed to lift anything more than, I think, 15 to 20 pounds at that point. So, you know, then it affected my job. And, you know, the way that I sort of live my day-to-day life, you just have to be really careful. And then, you know, I thought, okay, we can deal with this. We had to cancel our big family vacation for the summer. Major bummer. I was really upset about that because you can't travel when you have placenta previa. It's too risky. And so just, I feel like just as I had kind of come to terms with all of that and come to accept that, because of the placenta situation, I was referred to an MFM, a maternal fetal medicine specialist. And when I went to her, they did a more detailed ultrasound just with a better imaging. They had a better machine and found not only the host of other issues that I had, but also now vasa previa, which for anyone who doesn't know what vasa previa is, it's when those unprotected blood vessels that are in the umbilical cord are lying across the opening of the cervix, essentially blocking the birth canal. So if you were to go into labor, your water breaks and the baby drops down and puts pressure on those unprotected vessels, they can rupture. It's a real risk. And, you know, if umbilical cord vessels rupture, that's the baby's blood supply. And, you know, it can be a fatal thing for your baby. If you aren't rushed to the OR for an emergency C-section within about 5 to 10 minutes to get that baby out, you know, there's a real risk of a fatality there. And I'm sitting in the MFM doctor's office and she's telling me all of this, just thinking like, haven't there been enough issues? I cannot believe this is happening. The weight of the responsibility of carrying this child for someone else. And then all of this laid on top of me, just, it seemed massively unfair. And maybe that's selfish of me to think about because I didn't want to focus on, I'm doing this for somebody else, but also like, I can't believe that, that my life is being upset in this way when I'm trying to do a good thing.
Yeah. And I don't think that's an unfair thing. We have to remember, and I think everybody, even people around gestational surgarates, need to remember that we are humans who have lives that exist outside of this pregnancy, right? You're a mom, you've got three kids, you have a job, you have a husband, and those are priorities as well. And so I don't think it was selfish to think of, oh my God, what am I going to do now? My entire world just kind of imploded.
Yeah.
On top of the fact that you have this responsibility of carrying this baby and these parents that are so excited, like that's a lot to process. On top of, you know, what does this mean now? Right. How is this going to do? How are we going to do this? And so that's a totally reasonable response because that's life. Right. And so you hear all of this, you're trying to process, you find out about this vasa previa, then are you able to go home? Like, what does the next steps look like for you?
Well, the first thing after I got the news from my MFM doctor, the first thing I said was, okay, I need to know timeline wise, what does this look like? And so this was when I was about 24 weeks pregnant. And she said, here's what we need to do to, you know, have the best possible outcome and put you in the safest situation. You have to be admitted to the hospital. And we want to do that between 28 and 30 weeks. She said initially, our goal will be to shoot for 34 weeks for a delivery. Hopefully we can get you there. And that's not great news. I got in the car after that appointment and called my husband and just had a total breakdown and said, like, what are we going to do? We have three kids. He and I both have full-time jobs. How are we going to make this work? I have to live in the hospital for probably at least 6 weeks. What are we going to do? And in my mind and for myself, I'm very much we're going to figure this out. We're going to have a whole plan, because it makes me feel better to know that I have everything organized. And, you know, there's a real lack of control here in this situation. And so I wanted to try to organize and put together everything that I possibly could that I do have control over. And yep. So he and I worked together to figure out the childcare situation, my job, how that's going to go. I think really quickly that was what I did, was just get my life in order, knowing that this is in a few weeks, I'm going into the hospital and I need to make sure that everyone is getting what they need and everything is as organized as possible. And so that's what we did. And that's why having that support person is so crucial, because I couldn't have done it on my own.
Yep. It was probably a curse and a blessing that you had that date, right? At least yes. You had the time to process and get everything in order. But then it's kind of this looming like date of like, okay, it's coming. And then you kind of are, I'm sure, walking on pins and needles during those weeks, like hoping to at least make it to that date to get to the hospital. I know my MFM for my placenta previa was very intense. And always wanted to talk about worst case scenario. And so I was terrified. I felt like I was like a ticking time bomb. And if I stepped wrong or moved wrong, I was going to bleed out and everything. Like, it was horrible. So I can only imagine how nerve wracking those couple of weeks must have been prior to getting into the hospital, trying to get all of that done and process all of this. You made it though. you did it. You got through it. The best that you could. So you make it there. At what week were you eventually then admitted to the hospital?
So then we got to 28 weeks and I just felt, like you said, so nervous all the time. If I move wrong, if I strain myself too much, what's going to happen? I will never forgive myself if something happens to this baby that I could have prevented. I won't be able to get over it. And so I told my regular OB, who was going to be in charge of when I got admitted to the hospital, when I got to 28 weeks, I said, this is what I feel comfortable with. You know, I'm just so nervous all the time. I would like to go ahead and go into the hospital now at 28 weeks because that's where I'm going to feel the safest and that's what I need. And she was wonderful. And that's what I did. I was admitted at 28 weeks. And that's sort of, you know, how my hospital journey started.
So then were you on bed rest or just kind of there as your kind of station?
Initially, they told me that I was going to need to basically be on bed rest, that I could be wheeled around the hospital a little bit in a wheelchair, but that I wasn't really going to be able to get up and walk too much. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. I don't really know how long I'm going to be here and I can't even walk. And after I was there for, probably a week or two, and they saw that I was stable and all of my non-stress tests were looking good, I was allowed a little bit more freedom, but I was really only allowed to walk short distances. I mainly had to stay in the antepartum area of the hospital. I had to have IV access all the time just in case I had to be rushed back to surgery emergently. They needed to always have IV access. Really, it's a pretty boring time there. There's not a lot to do. It's pretty much Groundhog Day. Yeah. Every day.
So during this part of the process, though, baby's been looking good. Everything is looking good on that front.
Yeah.
What do your intended parents think about all of this? You have to kind of deliver this news to them of like, well, the baby is fine now, but we have these potentials. You said they were international. There's kind of a language barrier. How did they kind of process this, or how were you able to kind of tell them where this precarious situation was?
After I initially received the diagnosis of vasoprevia, I had to take a few days to sort of process that myself. And then after that, I did do a Zoom call with them, trying to explain everything. And sort of what the future looked like for us. They really couldn't have been more wonderful. They understood right from the beginning, like, this wasn't my fault. This was sort of the hand that I was dealt. And this is what we need to do to keep your baby safe. And I think they felt, you know, really guilty about everything that I was having to go through, all of these extra things that were not anticipated. And so after I told them, they planned on coming here and flying here to the city where I live fairly soon after I was admitted to the hospital. It was really important that they be here, and they wanted to visit me every day and be just an extra layer of support during that time, which, you know, not all intended parents would do that, especially when they live halfway around the world. I really didn't expect to have that kind of support from them, and so grateful for it. They could not have been more wonderful to me, and always wanted to be there to make sure that I had everything that I needed. Really, they usually came to visit me in the hospital twice a day. And it was never a burden for me, never annoying for me. I always wanted them around. I know not everyone would feel that way, but I truly have so much love for them. And I'm so grateful that they were there for me. So
yeah, I'm kind of in this together as much as you can be when it comes to that. And I think that's, you're right, that is support that maybe not everybody is able to give or receive. So I think that that's an amazing part of the story for you all, that they were so supportive and wanted to be a part of that whole process. So how long did you end up being in the hospital?
So I went in at 28 weeks. The original goal was to get the baby to 34 weeks, but the MFM doctors that rotate through the hospital where I was were different from my outpatient MFM, sort of in their take on vasopressin and what's safe and a goal of gestation to get me to. And so they told me, we really think we can shoot for 36 weeks, which obviously when you get to that point, it's a really vulnerable time for the baby. And so every week that you can tick off at that point, just give that baby a better and better chance. And I felt really good about, let's shoot for, you know, 35, 36 weeks. That sounds awesome to me. The intended parents were so happy to hear that, because 34 weeks, almost guaranteed you're going to have a NICU situation. And 35, 36, you may not. It can go either way. So I continued to have growth ultrasounds every couple of weeks, just watching the baby, because with the way that the cord was inserted, it can also cause growth restriction. And if you get to the point in a pregnancy where there's growth restriction and baby just stops growing well, it's better to get the baby out. So we were watching for that. And I did end up getting to schedule my C-section at 35 and 6. It felt like a huge accomplishment for me, right? It was more than I expected, for sure. Yeah.
You have the C-section, then did everything go okay there? Because I know with some of these placental things, it can cause complications during delivery, even if it is a planned C-section. Did everything go smoothly as far as delivery goes? And were the dads able to be there, or were they kind of waiting outside? How did your delivery end up going?
Yeah, I feel like with the way that the pregnancy had gone up until that point, I went into the delivery assuming the worst.
Yeah.
If I assume the worst and I have to have a hysterectomy, or, you know, that's a worst case scenario, like at least I'm prepared for that. I did really advocate for the dads to be present in the operating room. That was really important for me. I thought, we've been through so much together. You know, they only have one other embryo after this. I don't know if this will be their only child. This may be their only opportunity to see their child brought into the world. And so they were both able to be in the operating room, which was truly magical. I'm so thankful for it. They watched everything, and she came out pink and screaming. And it was just the best thing I've ever experienced. I mean, all your deliveries are different with your own kids, and it's magical and wonderful every time. But in this situation, with so much building up to this and me so scared about everything that could potentially go wrong, when she came out healthy and pink and crying, I just, again, more than I ever could have expected. And for them to be able to witness that was just the epitome of everything that I wanted.
Yep. The why, that look, that, and knowing what you did, that is the why. And it's a truly amazing to be a part of. And so she was born close to the 36. Did she end up needing any NICU time, or did you get her past the finish line?
She did not. She never needed respiratory support. She was a pretty good feeder right from the beginning. They did keep her in the hospital for 4 days just to kind of monitor her, make sure she wasn't going to get too jaundiced, and make sure that she wasn't going to lose too much weight. But no NICU time. she was great and got to go home after 4 days. So really amazing. Mm-hmm.
And then that is amazing that you got her there. So you finally have the delivery. Everything goes smoothly. Dads were there. You came out all parts intact. How much longer did you have to stay after you delivered?
Well, at that point, I had been in the hospital for almost 8 weeks. And so with my OB,
you're ready to go, man.
When I get out of here.
Yep.
And so I was just there for 2 nights to make sure that my pain was under control and the incision looked okay. And then I headed home because I just couldn't wait.
Yep.
I feel very lucky. The nurses in the hospital were incredible to me. They became like my best friends. My doctors were all wonderful, but you know, there's nothing like being at home in your own bed. I needed to be with my kids again. And so I had to get out.
Yep. Understandably, that is quite a journey that you had to go on to get this little one here, and especially unexpected. That's what we always say in surrogacy, to expect the unexpected. Ooh. Maybe not all of the unexpected all in one journey, all in one go, but you know, you were going for it. All of this, you know, it may not have been a pretty getting there, but in the end, you know, you were able to stay safe yourself and safely deliver a beautiful baby into her father's arms. A very happy ending to quite an intense beginning, I would say, to putting it mildly. So kind of knowing, you know, everything that you went through with complications and just surrogacy in general, do you have any advice that you'd give women considering becoming a surrogate?
Absolutely. I would say the first thing I would say is research. If you're going to go through an agency and not do an independent journey, I would say research your agencies really thoroughly. If there's any way that you can talk to someone else, another surrogate who's used that agency, to learn about their experience. When things go wrong, an agency is really crucial in coordinating a lot of things. And so I think having, you know, that person really who has your back at an agency is really important. I think I would tell women to be prepared for a lot physically, a lot more than you've experienced before. I think the hormones are intense. If you've never been through IVF, which I hadn't before, it's a lot of injections. It's a lot of medication. It's a lot to put your body through. It's an experience that you've never had before. And so just be prepared for it to be very different than other pregnancies that you've had. I think the number one piece of advice I would give someone, and I think if you are going through an agency, most of them will require this and make sure that it's in place, but having that support person in your life that you know is going to be there for you no matter what is crucial. Because, you know, I was in the hospital for 8 weeks. My husband had to do everything, which is more than one person should ever have to take on, taking care of our kids and working full time and taking care of our house. And he did it and he was wonderful. But what would I have done without him? I mean, I wouldn't have been able to survive at all. So having that person that you know is going to be there for you to support you through it, I mean, you have to have that.
Making sure that that support system is in place with whoever that is a wonderful piece of advice. What you did was amazing, and it's such a beautiful gift that you were able to give those intended parents. Obviously, it was much harder than it should have been, but that's kind of, you know, the name of the game in pregnancy. So just making sure that you are just fully informed on all of the possible risks, albeit them small. Some things are more common in IVF pregnancies than your typical one. So are you still in some contact with them? How is the baby settling in now with their new parents?
Yes, she just turned 2 months old and is growing, and she's beautiful and healthy. And I think they're doing great. We stay in communication. We message each other every week, and they've sent me pictures, and she looks fantastic. So
that's great. Yeah. And has your life kind of gone back to whatever normal is after, you know, 8 weeks in the hospital?
Yeah, but it took a while. I think I really struggled with, you know, the baby blues for the first 2 weeks after the delivery, but sort of in a different way than I ever had before. I personally, and I think this is something else that I would tell potential future surrogates is that, you know, I feel like I didn't know how to handle that. And I didn't think about that part of it. I had so much leading up to this delivery and the build up to that was so great. I didn't really think about what happens after, probably as much as I should have. Or maybe not, because maybe you just never know how that's going to be until you're going through it. But I found that it was a real letdown. And I was really sad for those first couple of weeks. And I think, again, having a support person to get you through that is really important. I think a lot of it was just the hormone crash that is inevitable after you deliver.
Whether you come home with a baby or not, that hormone crash happens. That's biology. There's nothing that you can do about that. It's interesting to navigate. Everybody thinks that, oh, well, you're getting sleep and you don't have to do this and this, but it's like, this is like on a biological level that crash happens. And then you add in the complexities of a surrogacy and your journey ending very differently, and the stress of all that and kind of coming down from that heightened level.
So I think, yeah, initially it was really hard for me. After 2 to 3 weeks, the fog sort of starts to lift, or it did for me. And I think after such a long process, I was so ready to just feel like myself again. It had just been such a long time. And so getting back to being able to do things with my kids, I'm back to work now. I've been back to work for a couple of weeks, which I couldn't wait to go back to work. I love my job. And that was an important part of me feeling normal again.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today and shedding light on the unexpected. And, you know, sometimes things don't go perfectly, but they end beautifully. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Normalize Surrogacy Podcast by Surrogacy Mentor. I want to thank our very special guest, Lindsay, for joining us for this chat today. Be sure to check us out online at surrogacymentor.com and modernparentmentor.com if you are interested in knowing whether surrogacy is right for you. And take our 2-minute easy quiz on our website if you're interested in becoming a surrogate. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to learn more about gestational surrogacy and how to have a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey. Talk to you next time.